to this day, if you see a guy like Dave Attell, and he's always at 1 a.m. at the Cellar, and nobody understands why he's not a little further along, even though anybody in the stand-up comedy world knows he's the greatest comic that may, when all is said and done, have ever lived. And Dave Chappelle will tell you that, and Chris Rock will tell you that, and all the best people in comedy will tell you Dave Attell is the greatest. And when you see him, 1 a.m. on a Tuesday at the Cellar, it's like seeing a Bob Dylan. And it's the reason you want to live in New York City, is to have that experience and see Dave Attell somehow do 20 minutes of new stuff, because he's so afraid that his peers are going to think he's a hack, comes up with 20 minutes of new stuff every night. It's unbelievable. And that's how the reputation grew, because it was more of an intelligent brand of comedy. You weren't there to split your gut laughing. You were trying to see these people get it together. I'm Dave Juskow, a comedian, and I'm a Cellar graduate. I approve this podcast.
Yes, as you just heard, that is the voice of comedian Dave Juskow. And you've tuned into another episode of Comedy History 101, where we school you in comedy. Hello, this is Harmon, and hi. And we are back with a brand spanking new episode on the history of the Comedy Cellar, along with Dave Juskow, who is a Comedy Cellar regular and the host of the Comedy Cellar Tuesdays podcast. As you might know, the Comedy Cellar is one of the most iconic comedy clubs in the world. Here in New York, it's considered the Yankee Stadium of comedy clubs. And so many great legendary comedians have gotten their start at the Comedy Cellar. We're talking your Dave Chappelle's. We're talking your Dave Attell's. We're talking your Todd Barry's. We're talking your Colin Quinn's. We're talking your Ray Romano's, your Jon Stewart's, etc., etc., and etc. And we are going to do a deep dive into the history of said comedy club. But before we jump into the episode, a few quick plugs. On Friday, March 8th, 7 p.m. at the People's Improv Theater, I'll be presenting my show, AI versus Human Roast Battle. Also, March 22nd, 23rd, I will be in London at the Rosemary Branch Theater doing my solo show, Harmon Leon in The Joke Saved My Soul. And you can find out about all these tour dates on my site at harmonleon.com or on the social medias at harmonleon. Also, take some time to like, subscribe, and comment on Comedy History 101, wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll read your comment right here on the podcast. Also, while you're at it, show us some love. Throw a few stars up there on, I don't know, Apple, if you get your podcast there. And now, without further ado.
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
I'm trying to use the phone!
Excuse me!
Comedy History 101.
So to jump right in, here's like a real softball question that I haven't even originated this question for this interview particularly, but if I were, hypothetical, a space alien who's just landed in planet New York, how would you describe the Comedy Cellar?
Well, I would say if you were looking for comedy, like if you were a space alien that seemed to know comedy and you were looking for stand-up comedy, I would say that the Comedy Cellar is the best place to go. The Comedy Cellar is still the best place where you're going to see the most professional comics. And as you can know, but the Comedy Cellar, but just by the lines alone and the fact that they have 9 shows a night and they're expanding by next year to, you know, a 5th or 6th room, you know, there's already 4 rooms at the Comedy Cellar, and they're making they took over that McDonald's down the street on 3rd Street. So obviously the people have spoken all over the world, and that's something the other clubs don't have, of where people will wait and try and get into the Comedy Cellar. I'm there almost every night, and the lines of people trying to get in or not understanding that you need reservations way in advance and stuff like that is like nothing I've ever seen before. So the Comedy Cellar still has the cachet that the other comedy places don't have. And the question is why? I don't know for real. I mean, it, obviously the level of comedians is there. There's been a change in the recent years of the maybe age that it's been better. Like they've had more younger comics come in and stuff. It used to be kind of the same comics for 30 years. But the big factor is you just don't know who may stop by and may just do a set out of nowhere and a surprise. And that's always been a big deal wherever you see comedy.
And what's your history with the club? When did you start going to the Cellar?
Well, I started going there in the late 80s, early 90s, was very happy to get on stage there and everything. But I don't even know where I got involved. I know I was banned there for a while.
Ooh, we could go into that later. With my question of the controversies over the years.
Yeah. But yes, I've been a Comedy Cellar. We call ourselves a Comedy Cellar family. And it's the kind of place that when you don't have anything else and it's New Year's Eve or something, I could go down and be with my friends that I have considered family over the years. And it's really quite a lovely community.
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
Yeah, I mean, is that one of the like personalities of the Cellar? Is it just sort of comedians first family sort of atmosphere that stems from, the ownership of the Olive Tree restaurant, which is above the Cellar?
Yeah, that's right. And that makes it different than all the other places. There's definitely a rich history to it. And its owner and its ownership and the way they treat the comics. It's
yeah, I
good.
Think, wasn't it like the first to have like a no heckling policy?
I don't know about that. I mean,
or it has a no heckling policy.
I'd like to think all the clubs have that.
Yeah.
That if there is trouble, somebody comes over right away. But somebody, obviously people can get through sometimes, I guess, if we're not expecting something. There's been controversy over the years of the comics that Noam, the owner, lets play there because he has a history with them. And maybe they, in this cancellation era we live in, where there's still really good quality comics who haven't really done anything wrong, and the owner wants to let them play there, and then people start walking out, which is completely new. You know, they had to go through that as well to still make it to where they are the best.
Yeah, and what logistically makes it the best? Kind of give us a walkthrough tour of, basement club, low ceilings.
Well, you're talking about, the first, where it first started, the actual Comedy Cellar on McDougal Street. Yeah, it's odd that a place like that would be the best place. It's just a stupid, true cellar basement that just had a bunch of leftover furniture in it that nobody was doing anything with to become the greatest comedy club in New York, at least for sure. And then really the country. But I mean, you can make a case for other places out in California, but this place, yeah, it's crazy. Cause it's a cellar, a true basement cellar. It's not flashy. The bathrooms are kind of gross.
Is it still like the people upstairs have to walk through the comedy room to use the bathroom from the restaurant?
That's why I never pee there. I use a bar across the street that we have a relationship with, because yeah, I refuse to walk through the comedians, because especially if David Tell, for instance, is on stage, he will make fun of me when I go to the bathroom, and I don't need that if I'm just going to pee. But it's also the greatness of the club too, just because I don't want to get made fun of. Some people love it. But it is funny if you're just an average person and my mother, I'm taking to the Olive Tree restaurant and to pee, she's got to go through the comics. And
yeah,
somebody's
and have like Nick DiPaolo, like rip her a new one.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's kind of hilarious.
Yeah.
So, again, that's interesting as hell. It's a great, fascinating reason to also go even just to the restaurant.
Yeah. So take us back. So I believe it was 1981 when the club started. A comic, Bill Grunderfield, is Bill it?
Grunfest.
Grunfest. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. So Bill Grunfest, right. The place wasn't a comedy club. They had the Cafe Wa next door, which was, that was all owned by the same person, which is Gnomes Dorman's dad. And he owned the club. And he owned the restaurant, the Olive Tree. And the basement was just full of furniture. And that was where the bathrooms were. And Bill Grunfest just said, you know, you should think about doing stand-up comedy here. We should have a show. And they're like, yeah, that, I guess we could do that. I mean, it's really as easy as that. Somebody said, this is a great room to have a show, which is so funny because so many people do that with rooms. I mean, you and I met where Susie Felber put together a show at the Elks Club.
Yeah.
And, and why doesn't that become the Comedy Cellar? Right? It's the same premise. It's just a little room in the middle of nowhere. Well, I mean, granted, this one's in the West Village.
Yeah, that's Weehawken. So right, it's a right. Little, yeah.
But there's plenty of rooms in the West Village that don't become the Comedy Cellar. There's-
yeah. That's again, it's like the logistics. And again, you know, just producing shows in New York, I've gone on foot walking around looking for venues and just, you know, and again, the history of the Village is, you know, you have the Bitter End, you have, you know, all those music venues where, say, you know, Cheech and Chong got their start, or that's Woody right. Allen, or, you know, Lenny yep. Bruce. And yeah. What was like the year? Was that all kind of like on a wane out, or what was the New York comedy scene going on back then? I mean, well, now it's just like the Edinburgh Festival where every bar has a comedy show, but, you know, different year.
I think what happened, I mean, I came in around 1987 when I, not the Comedy Cellar, that was where you wanted to strive to play. Even it had a good reputation even back then, not the reputation it has now. It was a really good one though, but it was a comedy club you wanted to get into. But in 1980, when I started comedy in like 1983, there were just comedy clubs. It's funny now when there's comedy rooms and all this expansion. And I think that came from the level of comedy that was on television. So there was only comedy clubs. There was Catch a Rising Star. There was the Improv, which you see on Seinfeld on 44th and 9th. There was the Comic Strip and the Comedy Cellar. And I don't even think I've forgotten one. And these were there were four or five places you could play if you were a comic. And people tried to build stuff, but they would go up and come down, and they just couldn't compete with the actual comedy clubs.
Yeah, was his intent just to like have like a one-nighter club, like, you know, we see now in, you know, typical barroom New York kind of rooms, or was it?
That wasn't a thing. That's what, now I remember my place. That mm-hmm. wasn't a thing. It was then all of a sudden A&E started doing comedy shows like the Improv. The Improv out in L.A. started Evening at the Improv. And then Caroline's came up with the Caroline's Comedy Hour. And then there was A&E Comedy on the Road, which included a lot of other places in Chicago and Phoenix and all these kind of places. And so Sunday nights on the A&E channel would be live stand-up comedy, taped stand-up comedy, but on television. And that started this incredible boom of the adage of like, what is everybody's a comic now, became true. And everybody wanted to get into stand-up comedy. It used to be a very minor amount of people. And it wasn't like it is today, where really everyone thinks they can make it as a stand-up comic now. It's really a disaster in many ways. The worst people and the best people were only trying to get it. I mean, there was always people that really thought they were, and they stuck with it and they sucked, but the best people really got through. And now it's just totally different. But everybody seemed to, and once it was on TV, everybody said, well, I can do this. It was, you had this, the comics on the late shows, and that's it. You had the comics on the Tonight Show and Letterman and the Merv Griffin Show. And that's the only time you could see comedy on television. And then it expanded with all these people you'd never heard of before, which led the mentality to be like, well, I could probably do that too, which totally happened to me. The first time, if this is interesting to you, the first time I did stand-up was in 1983. I was watching the David Letterman show. He was on at 12:30 at night. And for some reason, you know, he couldn't get a lot of guests. And at 1:30 in the morning, the show was an hour, he had the owner of this very small but legendary club in Brooklyn called Pips.
Oh, yeah, and Andy Kaufman, one of his early gigs was at Pips.
Maybe. I know Andrew Dice Clay started there for sure. I don't know if Andy Kaufman was in the city. I know he's more L.A., so that, but that could be true. And that club was legendary. It was a place right in Sheepshead Bay, Brooklyn. And so he had the owner of this club on. I mean, this really small club. It was hilarious. That could never happen today. I mean, Gnome could be on a show, but not a club. The guy from the Village Lantern isn't going to be on the Tonight Show, you know?
Yeah, the Grizzly Pair.
Right, exactly. They're not going to. They could be on a smaller show. Yeah. You know? Anyway, so he goes, I'll never forget it. And he goes on, he goes, well, you know, Wednesdays, we got an open mic. You come down, you sign up, we'll put you on. And I'm watching it, and I'm like, oh, my God, I'm going to do that. And so I went to Brooklyn. I lived in New Jersey, and I'm dressed up in a tie because that was the attire back then. You dressed up because that's what you saw on TV. Everybody's dressed up. And I thought there was going to be a huge line. No one was there. Nobody was watching Letterman at 1:30. I mean, there was a couple of us, but nobody was committed to comedy. Yeah, I signed up. They put me on. It was exciting. I mean, it was just as easy as that back then. Mm-hmm. So I went in the summers every Wednesday while I was in college. And it was really terrific and met all these lovely people. And then when I got out of college, I started trying to perform in the city.
Yeah.
And me and David Tell and, you know, then this guy, Mike Royce and stuff. We all tried to get on. We all tried to get to places like the Comedy Cellar and the Improv. That was the goal, which I don't even know whether that's the goal anymore.
Well, you know, there's so many different outlets. You know, you could be a TikTok star and that's your venue. But, you know,
that's changed everything.
Yeah. Yeah. But when you're coming up, who was like on your regular lineups at the Cellar?
Well, that's the
most
hilarious.
Who were the heavy hitters?
Well, so the way the Cellar kind of came to where it is this guy, Bill Grunfest, started the show and they had people there. And then there was this guy, Mark Cohen, who is now the house MC at the Comedy Cellar in Vegas, and his friend Mike Rowe, and they kind of made the Cellar an awesome place. And they had a little comedy team together, Rowe and Cohen, and they made it fun and late night and a late night happening, and built it up to where it got to the level close to where it is today, and made it exciting. And like I said, right in the heart of the West Village, which was a big happening late night place. I mean, you're talking about Catch Rising Star, which is a great place. That's on 77th Street and First Avenue. That wasn't a big late night happening there.
Yeah.
This made it
like
fun
Midtown.
To go. Right. And this made it fun to go at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, midnight, and this place would still be happening. So these two guys kind of bought in other comics, and Colin Quinn was there when I started, and Kevin Brennan, who now has been let go, like canceled, I guess, even though he's incredible to me still. But
is that Neil Brennan's brother?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. In fact, Neil Brennan always credits me with helping him in comedy because we took him around Kevin brought him around when he was like 11. And I guess I was funny because he was 11. I'd be like, listen, kid, this business will chew you up and spit you out. And he knew I was kidding and he got the gag even at 11, you know, that I was playing the old guy with the cigar, you know, and telling him that. So he got comedy at a very young age, which was obvious. So anyway, so these guys started it and then it became like this really fun, interesting place. Ray Romano was there. I'm trying to think, obviously, who was there.
Yeah, I think more interesting is like, who did you see really struggling in their early years? Like, I was reading this Vanity Fair article on the oral history of the Cellar. It was like Jon Stewart would just bomb on a regular basis. And he worked at the Mexican restaurant down the street.
That's Panchito's. That's right. That's where I met him. He worked there. He wasn't even working the Cellar yet. You know, he had to aspire to get there too. We're about the same. We started around the same time. And yeah, he'd bomb all the time. He hated comedy. But anybody that knew comedy knew him and David Tell, who would you know, think that he's bombing, just like Jon Stewart. They weren't bombing. Anybody that knew comedy knew there was something special about these two in particular. And somebody like Colin Quinn also would technically be, quote, bombing. But it wasn't bombing. And if you were an intellect in any kind of way, this was like seeing Bob Dylan in that same neighborhood and getting it. And that's how the reputation grew, because it was more of an intelligent brand of comedy. You weren't there to split your gut laughing. You were trying to see these people get it together. And if you got it, then it was the best time you could ever have. And just like people got Bob Dylan at the beginning, you're like, this guy can't even sing. I don't even think he carries a tune. But it's the same thing. I mean, really, to this day, if you see a guy like Dave Attell, and he's always at 1 a.m. at the Cellar, and nobody understands why he's not a little further along, even though anybody in the stand-up comedy world knows he's the greatest comic that may, when all is said and done, have ever lived. And Dave Chappelle will tell you that, and Chris Rock will tell you that, and all the best people in comedy will tell you Dave Attell is the greatest. And when you see him, 1 a.m. on a Tuesday at the Cellar, it's like seeing a Bob Dylan. And it's the reason you want to live in New York City, is to have that experience and see Dave Attell somehow do 20 minutes of new stuff, because he's so afraid that his peers are going to think he's a hack. Comes up with 20 minutes of new stuff every night. It's unbelievable. Yeah, and it cannot be seen on television. That's the problem. His stuff is good enough, but you're not getting his greatness when he does television.
Yeah. And do you think like that's like comedians like Attell, just the room kind of, you know, I was reading this book, I think it was written by David Byrne of the Talking Heads, that said, like, you know, music's dictated by the room. Like, say, the music that came out of CBGB's was dictated by these low ceilings and kind of logistics, where like a church where sound goes everywhere. Do you think a style of comedy was dictated by the style of the room of the Comedy Cellar?
Excellent question. I've been to CBGB's before, and he's exactly right. It was such a shithole that you're right. It's the thing of the, you're in a shithole. And you're seeing greatness. And you're right. The sounds that are coming out. I saw the Ramones there. And I saw other, I mean, up till Hole, you know, with what's her face. And, you know, seeing a band there was obviously exciting. And it was like a happening. And when you're there, you knew it was greatness. Obviously, by the time I got there, CBGB's had a really good reputation. But you're absolutely right. The Comedy Cellar, when you're there, especially the original location, you really think it's a happening. It is exactly like you're saying with CBGB's. The low ceilings, that the audience, it permeates. It's the laughs are coming fast and furious. And the fact that you have to struggle to even get on the stage, and that it is small, and Dave Chappelle is going to maybe walk up to this small, little, very intimate room. Yeah, that's a great question, and you're absolutely right. I'm sure that has something to do with it. When all the other comedy clubs had very, very big rooms, this is small and intimate, and a guy can sit on a chair and make you laugh for a half hour.
And then there's gonna be somebody going through right in front of you using the bathroom from the restaurant upstairs. So
that
therefore,
makes it you're, old you're, school. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. So therefore, you gotta interact.
Excuse me.
These guys kind of got it going and got the reputation in the late 80s, early 90s, and then it was really to make it what it is today. I think it was Louis C.K. and his show, Louis, that really made it the level of what it is today, where the owner can buy that McDonald's down the street and open a fifth room.
Yeah, I never heard about the McDonald's. That's exciting. You know, again, yeah, they're going to own that whole two-block area.
That legendary, horrible McDonald's on 3rd Street that had nothing but nonsense and chaos for so many years is now purchased by the Comedy Cellar, and they're going to make it a, you know, a big room, which is good for me, because then they let me do different kind of stuff. The owner, thank God, known this guy is so great. He's always up for doing interesting things, which the other rooms allow you to do, like readings and stuff that you do, storytelling nights, things like that. Whereas the other room is only for stand-up comedy, as it should be. You want to make sure there's always just stand-up there for the people that love stand-up, the weirdos that still like just regular stand-up comedy.
Yeah, and so what are the features of the cellar is the legendary comedian's table. Can you tell us a little bit about that and its origin?
Yeah, somebody just told me about the origin. I can't even remember now, but I remember, you know, it was the greatest holy grail of really making it in comedy if you were able to sit there. And obviously, it was just there was no green room, so you just had an area that was the comics needed to hang out. And you could also get, they also give you a free meal or half off. I don't know when it started. Now I think it's free. And we needed a place. The comedians needed a place. The place didn't have a green room. Well, the other places used to have a bar. The Improv had a bar. The Catch Rising Star had a bar. The Comic Strip has a bar. You can see in Seinfeld, the bar. I mean, I know that's just a studio, but it's supposed to be the original Improv on 44th Street. And they have a bar the comics hang out in, not a green room. So the cellar had nothing because they had a restaurant upstairs, not a just a bar. So they just needed an area. They had this table in the back of the room. And finally, they had to put a note there because people were bringing people that weren't allowed to sit at the comics table. You know, they'd bring guests. You had to be really careful.
How do you get invited over? Is it like one of those old school Johnny Carson invites you over to the couch sort of thing?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, I hadn't passed there and they just let me stay there. I'm like, oh, maybe I should go. And they're like, no, you're one of us. And I'm like, really? Yeah. How did I get passed? I don't know. You had to be recommended, you know, like Colin Quinn said, it's okay if Just Gow sits here at Attell, and all the great people that I know were like, oh, Just Gow's one of us. And he's cool and he's allowed to. I mean, really, it's like that. And now, I mean, if you're working at the club, if you passed and you then you can sit there. But the comedy table isn't what it used to be. They made some renovations a few years ago and changed the kitchen area. So now it's a smaller table. It's not what the dimensions don't make it the table it was. And now it's kind of all scattered out. And it's funny, Attell and I talk about this all the time. The people that sit there I don't know. Sometimes we just don't feel like we belong there anymore, I guess. Maybe it's for younger kids. I don't know. It depends on the day that you're there and who's performing. So it doesn't have the same feel as it did before they changed the dimensions of the room. But it's still, especially if you're a younger comic, it's very exciting to be there. You know, you're sitting with the booker, Esty, which is really, like you said,
She's the original booker from the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, from wow. There's never been another, which is why she was booking the same people for 30 years. She has all her lineups. She showed us about, I guess, just before COVID, which of course is every story that happens nowadays. She showed us the 1992 listing and the 2019 listing. And there were like definitely 5 to 7 comics that were still playing there. You know,
who would be like in that sort of rotation?
What's the guy that just did his thing with Amy Schumer? He just had a stroke, basing on his name, and I've known him for years. And Keith Robinson. Sorry, that was going to kill me. And Attell, and I'm trying to remember who was on that list. And Colin. So like it's a, you know, those the names off the top of my head. Obviously, I can't think right now. If I thought about it more, I'd probably like tonight I'll be sleeping. I'll be like, yeah, right. But yeah, it was like the same. There were 5 to 7 of the same names. And it wasn't, it's not like Esty was old and didn't know how to book anybody else. But these guys were still great.
Yeah.
And still willing to play the cellar and send in their avails. On the flip side of that, I think they started bringing in other people. She started passing people that might not even be ready yet after COVID or during COVID because she realized, well, once Keith had his stroke, I think that changed stuff because she goes, oh, my regulars are dying. I better get some new people.
Yeah.
So for a tiny bit of time, people that weren't ready were getting passed because they were trying something new and really auditioning a whole bunch of people. And now it's leveled off again where it's just the cream rises above.
Yeah. And was it the comedian's table? Was that the basis of Colin Quinn's Tough Crowd TV show?
I don't know if that was it. I mean, it definitely had the people who were sitting at that table, but no, I think that was just based on his stand-up and what he did and how he was perceived as a comic and how interested he was in current events and the news and talking about it on stage. I think it more came for that. However, everybody that was on that show, right, like Greg Giraldo and people like that, and we all just would have these conversations at the comics table. Yeah. Yes, I suppose there is a thing to that. There's probably somebody there that reporters and TV cameras have come in through the years and are always fascinated by the way it works and the conversations we had at the table. I can point out many examples. For instance, even I had a writer from Elle magazine back in the 90s, which I'm sure you can find somewhere, where I bought it. He was fascinated with how it worked, and I bought him not only over to the cellar to see everybody, but then to the comics table. Like, you know, we got permission for him to sit there, and then went over to Mark Cohen's house afterwards, where the comics would go at 3 a.m. and just hang out. And again, still just be funny, not trying new material, but just like, that's what we all did. And it was so much fun. It's so not like that anymore. Now people go home and just work on their stuff or do TikToks, but there wasn't that. So we all got together, went to a diner or went to somebody's house and hung out. And Mark Cohen's was the place where everybody hung out late night and drank, got high. And just because nobody had to wake up until 3 p.m.
Yeah. So do you think was it the opening credits of Louis that you think really kind of made it the modern comedy seller? Or was it the 2002 Jerry Seinfeld movie Comedian?
That had an impact, but not at the cellar. Louis was the one, and that was when his show was really popular. Everybody started going there. He hosts Saturday Night Live. Then it became even more, and they did an imitation of his show with the Comedy Cellar. That is when it all really came.
Well, here's a logistical question: when did the actual cellar sign go up?
No, I don't know. I don't know.
It was like, you know, just a bar room or a basement.
I've been sitting there like I was with you with Outside Steve, who's been working there for a long time. And it's so funny. We have seen people go, can you tell me where the Comedy Cellar is? You know, there's that big lit up sign. Yeah. And he's just like, all right, get out.
Yeah.
You know, you're not allowed in, even if you have a reservation, you're too stupid.
Yeah. And just a couple of last questions. One controversy I read about was Donald Trump Jr. got punched out there. I think it was in 2002. Have you heard anything about that?
No, I don't remember that. There's been a lot of controversies that have happened there over the years. One that affected my life somehow, which was a disaster, was, you know, it's been in the paper. Dave Chappelle and Dave Attell got into a fight there, because Chappelle wouldn't get off stage and Attell was yelling at him, but in a funny way. And people perceived it as a fight, which it was not.
It was I say Chappelle, like, but, you know, do 5-hour sets.
Exactly. Right.
In San Francisco.
It was Attell's birthday. And, you know, we were booing him because Chappelle can handle it.
Yeah.
But so there's always been controversy. There's always been punching out. There's been punching out of other comics sometimes. And there's always been celebrity nonsense
on stage, or in front of crowds or just backstage.
No, it usually happens afterwards. Like on those steps that we walk down after the show, you know, because people hang out on those steps.
Oh, like who? I think I've read something about someone. I mean, that's vague, but
I don't know. A lot of comics, and I wouldn't mention their names. A lot of them have short tempers, which is surprising, because when you see them on stage, you're like, oh, I wouldn't have thought they had a short temper, but they do. But again, with that comics table, I just want to tell you, like, even up until Marina Franklin, FX did a show about women in comedy, which is, you know, I don't know, is that, I feel like that's almost an embarrassment to do a thing like that at this point, but they were doing one, and they came, of course, they had to come to the comics table. And it was Judy Gold and Marina and myself. I was there. I don't know why I was there.
Yeah.
But I remember I was making fun. I shouldn't have been there. It's just mostly the women. But people are always fascinated by the way things work, comics work, and the way they live their lives and stuff. It's just so different now. It was a lot more entertaining back then. Now the drugs and alcohol don't seem to be as fun as a mix as they used to be. You know, like you said, the TikTok is taking over. Now you get clubs that have TikTok people instead of comedians that sell out. And you can't blame the owners for wanting them, but they don't know what they're doing. We were at the Stress Factory, New Brunswick, and some TikTok 19-year-old kid, the place was packed with 25-year-old girls. And he goes to his father, so what am I supposed to do? And he's like, well, just talk, you know, like you do on TikTok. I'm like, Jesus. And, you know, there's people that would kill to have a headlining gig at places like that. But the climate has changed. What are you going to do?
Yeah. And so what do you remember as, you could take your pick on this one, either your best set or your worst set at the cellar?
Well, actually, ironically, the worst set I ever had there was this thing that got me this television show. It's kind of odd. I did this thing on Caroline's Comedy Hour that was legendary in TV and I guess kind of made my bones in the business. I always told people, like, well, I never heard of you before. And I'm like, yeah, because I had one good set. And they're like, why do you know so many famous comedians? Why do they think you're okay to hang out with? I go, because I had one good set in 1996 and it was on this show. And before, when I was practicing it, it never worked, but it worked this one day, fortunately on TV. So there is footage, but I don't know if it holds up today. And that was a horrible set. And I remember even afterwards, my agent dropped me. I was so bad. But the Cellar is not where I've had my worst sets. I've had them in Atlantic City and Vegas. I've been booed off stage before. But the best sets were multiple times where that crowd is just so great and fun. And because of, I think, like you say, the dimensions. I like the other room, the Village Underground, which holds 200 people instead of the 100. I felt that at home in there. I like walking through the audience with a wireless mic and just talking to people. There's still a closeness in that theater that's fun, and the comics still like it. And again, it's an underground, deep, cavernous place where it seems like it's a secret. And then you're all there together enjoying fantastic entertainment.
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
And lastly, what do you think the Comedy Cellar's place is in comedy history? Well, I know now, you kind of just summed it up like over the last.
Oh, no, that's
minutes,
okay.
Yeah.
I mean, now it's a legendary place that will be now and forever known as the base. Like, what is it, the Bitter End or the other place that closed? One of the places closed that everybody played. Dylan and all those people starting in the 60s, Lenny Bruce, like you're saying. The Bitter End, there was another place that was always in that West Village area. One of them closed forever, but it'll always be known as the place. In every history book or Wikipedia, it'll be like, and he used to play here. I mean, the Comedy Cellar will be that legendary place.
And that wraps up our episode today on the history of the Comedy Cellar. And you can find out more about Dave Juskow's comedy dates at his site, davejuskow.com, and check out his podcast, Comedy Cellar Tuesdays. And as always, remember to take time to like, subscribe, and comment on Comedy History 101, wherever you get your podcasts, or on our site, comedyhistory101.com, and we will read your comment right here on the podcast, such as this. We have a comment from Ozarathustra on the history of Triple X Party Records. Ozarathustra writes, love this. And this is spelt with two S's. Well, thank you very much, Ozarathustra. And remember, on March 8th, 7 p.m. at the People's Improv Theater, I'll be presenting my show, AI versus Human Roast Battle. Also, March 22nd, 23rd, I will be in London at the Rosemary Branch Theater doing my solo show, Harmon Leon in The Joke Saved My Soul. And you can find out about all these tour dates on my site at harmonleon.com or on the social medias at Harmon Leon. And until next time, bye-bye.
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
I'm trying to use the phone!
Excuse me!
Comedy History 101.